Hello everyone, welcome back to the fire. I'm Kylie Payne, and today is my birthday. I am turning 26. That's more than one quarter of a century. Kind of strange for me, because I can remember quite vividly what it was like to be, you know, a very young child. I have memories stretching back all the way, you know, to like way back. And so for me to be 26 seems a little, you know, astonishing. Can't imagine, you know, where I'd possibly be when in another 25 years, when I'm, you know, 50 or turning 51. So it seems like such a long, long ways away right now, but, you know, fingers crossed that it'll get here and it'll pass and I'll still be around. But there's really, really no telling for sure. So that's why, you know, we're living life day to day and working in the now, and, you know, everything is cumulative. It builds upon itself. So what I'm doing now will affect me 25 years from now. I've been very happy with myself for being able to put out these episodes on a regular basis, and you know, just barely getting this one out on time, because again, it's October the 12th, Monday, that's supposed to be releasing this podcast. And, you know, typically I try to get these done ahead of time, but this time I was just so busy that it's having to come out the day of. So it is what it is. And again, I'm glad at least I'm going to be able to get it out on time. Life has been interesting. We have moved into this house here in Alabaster, and it's still not completed. Kitchen's not done, so we're sort of having to make do with a little makeshift, microwave, crock pot, cutting table sort of space. At least we have a working refrigerator. But I'm certainly glad to be here nonetheless. I recognize that I'm very fortunate to be able to have this space. And, you know, for such a reasonable rate. And I'm really looking forward to making use of the studio space. Roommate Nabi has already started organizing an art night to take place. You know, we're going to invite a couple friends over and just create for a couple hours. It's been a while since we've been able to do one of those. And so, certainly looking forward to getting this one off the ground. Just wanted to make mention real quick about the What Do You Think of the Fountain project. It's finally been completed and released on YouTube. You can type in What Do You Think of the Fountain on YouTube and hit enter, and it should be the first result. It's the story of the fountain, the storyteller fountain at Five Points South in Birmingham, Alabama. The storyteller fountain was created by Frank Fleming and is curated by the Birmingham Museum of Art. So we talked to Frank and some of the curators and just, you know, passersby on the street, asking them, what do you think of the fountain? And, you know, trying to get all-inclusive views on this piece that has garnered a little bit of controversy. But I think, as you know, we come to find out, it's mostly sort of, colloquial, like, you know, ribbing or whatever, you know, people just sort of hinting at these, you know, so-called satanic undertones of the fountain, but I don't think, you know, it's a very, very minor minority that actually ascribes that sort of association to the piece. still hoping we can line up one or two screenings, public screenings somewhere in Birmingham. If we can find a venue that'd be interested in wanting to do that and, try to find an audience that'd be willing to come see it. Yeah, this project was many years in the making, and I feel like we've, as a group, have matured as individuals and professionally as well in the time since then. And looking back, there are certainly many critiques that I have as far as my own, camera, working behind the camera, cinematography, it's like the narrative and the editing. There's things that I wish that I could change, but we've already put so much time and effort into it, and with no budget, so we, like should have gotten like an actual mic to record some of these interviews next to the fountain because of the just the amount of atmospheric noise that we're competing with. But again, hindsight's 2020. I'm just glad that that account exists in the world now and is accessible for anybody to go and view it. My monologue here is rambling on a little bit longer than they usually do, and that is in part because of the decreased length of the interview that I have today, which, starting out this project, I was originally aiming for these to be about an hour long, and I just found that through the conversations that I was having, that these are not hour-long conversations. These are longer than that. Most of my episodes are turning into an hour 30, hour 40-minute long episodes, and that's because the conversation is so in-depth and engaging that I can't break away and don't want to cut it short without having any sort of proper wrapping up. So, but today's episode is a bit peculiar in that regard, in that the conversation was only 50 minutes long, and that's due to the time constraints placed upon okay, so let me just tell it to you this way. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Shay Stevenson. He's a local individual who I met through Monolith, and I'm not going to go into it too much because we cover this in the actual episode. But so I tried to set up with him earlier in the week and just record it digitally, and there was some technical issues there, and after meeting up with him in person this time around, I can kind of, I guess, understand why it didn't work out and why he would, prefer to want to meet in person. And that's totally understandable. So anyways, yeah, we rescheduled to meet in person at the Monolith Studios, so that we can have a nice little, quiet space to record in. And I guess it's okay for me to say this because, again, Shay brings it up later in the episode. But so yeah, like I'm getting ready to head up to Birmingham, and I message him saying like, "Hey, I'm heading up that way," and he says that he's currently with a friend at the hospital. He's waiting there until his friend's family can arrive, because his friend had decided to try to overdose, and commit suicide. And I guess was having second thoughts and contacted Shay, and Shay, being the individual that he is, dropped what he was doing, went and helped his friend, and told me that, he still wanted to do the interview. He wanted to take his mind off of the situation after having dealt with it, but certainly wanted to deal with it before breaking away and coming to meet me, which I totally understand and respect. So yeah, I ended up just hanging out at the Monolith Studios for a little bit, and ended up meeting a band that uses the Make Behem space to practice. They're called Through the Sparks, and apparently they're, one of the staples of Birmingham. So it was cool meeting those folks and talking to them. They all seemed really nice, people to have a beer and converse with, as I did. And looking forward to bumping into them in the future as well. So yeah, it wasn't ideal. It wasn't, as I had planned, but I think it worked out for the best. I ended up meeting those new folks, and then I think having the conversation in person, probably benefited from that more than had it just been a essentially a phone call. And even the content of this episode is not exactly as I had planned. I wanted to cover a little bit of Shay's involvement in the Birmingham noise scene and just sort of, get a temperature of the scene here. And which we do a fairly, encompassing conversation there on that topic, but I also wanted, like, the whole reason why I wanted to record with him to begin with is because of the way that he is choosing to raise his child and have a family, and wanted to cover that, and we really just scratched the surface of that, and then we end up going into a bit of the philosophy behind why he's doing that, and even on that front, we only again scratched the surface because there's really so much within that field, which I think he prefaces what he says several times about, like, that, my way isn't for everybody, and I'm not saying that, you're less of a person or you're doing it wrong because you're not doing it my way, but because he's raising. And at least, I don't think he specifically uses these words, so I'm going to be putting words in his mouth. But he's raising his child as an anarchist, with an anarchist philosophy in mind, at least. And I think that there's something very brave and noble about that, and respectable about that. And I'm really looking forward to meeting with Shay again and talking some more about this sort of stuff, because there's always I guess new interesting ideas that people share with me that I'm not aware of, or just offer differing perspectives, and it's I guess rare that you come across somebody. At least that I come across somebody who is educated in a bit of anarchist philosophy. That being said, I've been surprised that I've met the number of readers of anarchist philosophy that I have met. There's quite a number of them in the area. I've been surprised over the years to, I'm constantly bumping into more, and that's what it takes is getting out and talking to people, because some people subconsciously or intrinsically have these ideas, but they don't label it or recognize it as such. And they don't have the vocabulary to express it in I guess an educated fashion. But those people do exist. We are out there and we are everywhere, apparently. You just have to know where to look and what to say. Towards the end, some of our conversation may start to sound like it, veers off the deep end a little bit, and goes, a little bit, like, conspiracy theorist, doomsday prepper, or whatever. And I don't want that to be the connotation that viewers or listeners walk away with, because that there's, I think we are living in a closed system, and with finite resources, and yeah, there's only so much we can do before what we do is starts having adverse effects on the world and thus us as well, because we live in an interconnected world where we are all one at some fundamental level. So we have to recognize this and adapt to this new mindset. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy the show, like The Walking Dead, or or any I guess really good drama, any good fiction, because it like shows us how like people are always the problem, or it's like, whatever the problem is, it's how we come to it that is going to affect the outcome. We can talk all we want about like American ingenuity and American exceptionalism, whatever. But we've undercut ourselves and exported, outsourced so much that, what have we left ourselves with? If the system that we've grown to depend upon were to fall apart, then what would happen to us? We would fall apart as well. Which is why it's so important to already have, your escape route, your backup plan, you're designated, like, this is where we meet when things go down, because once it's already happened, it's too late. Like, you have to have some amount of prep laid down before the disaster hits. And I think that might be one of the reasons why these past couple of years I've not been focused so much on the, I guess, what one could see as the destructive forces of change, like getting out and protesting and causing a scene and putting a wrench in the gears, as the saying goes, because I think the system's already teetering and is, about to topple, and it's going to do itself in on that front. It's only a matter of time. And so our real focus, where we need to be putting our energy, is in these alternate structures and systems that will become the life rafts once the ship starts to sink. Not every life raft is going to hold together. Some may be overcrowded, some may be inefficiently built, but some of us on some of the you know the some of us will be able to sail away and start over again. And that's taking the best of a bad situation. I mean, we can argue all day over whether it's too late or not to avoid the iceberg, but I feel like we need to be prepared for the worst case scenario, regardless of whether or not it's coming, because we'll only benefit in the long run. Okay, so I had to step away from the mic for a little bit, and I kind of forgot where I was, and seeing as how I'm pressed for time, I think I'm just going to go ahead and cut right into the episode. I've been rambling for quite long enough now. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Shay Stevenson. See you on the other side. Cool, yeah. Test, test, test.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, I think that's picking up pretty good. Let me move a little bit closer.
Right. Do like the space. They've really changed it.
Yeah, I think I've got like a couple pictures, or I've got the picture where like it was before all the artwork, and they got like the tablecloth, and I feel like is like the carpet different, or maybe it just it got cleaned.
Maybe it's just the different colors in there make it appear as such.
Yeah, but yeah, it definitely looks a lot nicer than what it started with.
No, this is a good space. I'm not sure how to make use of this piano or the leavings of it, but I'm definitely thinking in my mind about what could be done with it.
Yes, it's interesting conversation piece, if nothing else. But I like all those little moving parts, the hammers and all. There's something to
I
be
can't
done.
quit touching it and just being like just fiddling and seeing, okay, well, how could we use this? What can we do with this? Interesting.
Yeah. Cool. So,
sitting down today with Shay, and your last name is?
Stevenson.
Stevenson, Shay Stevenson. Yeah. This is the first time I'm sitting down talking with you, and first time I met you was this monolith meeting at Milton's house a little while back.
Right.
And I've met a lot of people through just like being involved with Monolith, and everybody seems to be like really cool, like a lot of really good ideas going on, and everybody just seems to be down with collaborating and working with one another. That's an energy that I want to be a part of. So you want to tell a little bit about how you came into the fold and what you've been up to?
I've always kind of done experimental music, and Milton and I met each other through that. And when Mono got started, it was sort of a live recording space venue, but our idea that we had was to make it more of a collective, and rather than it being individual projects where I was doing something or he was doing something, where it was just sort of like a loose affinity network of people who could just like spontaneously collaborate on whatever muse was guiding them at the time. And at some point, he brought in Mike, who was, building all this where we sit, the Monolith radio station, and those two things somewhat congealed together. And Mono, is no longer there, but this is seems to be kind of what came out of it.
Yeah, the phoenix from the ashes.
For sure.
I met Mike back, when he was doing Green Cup, and, I was a volunteer there, and then, fell out of contact for a little while, but then, he let me know when he got involved with this, and that sort of, my shoe in into everything. I wish I would have been able to go to, more shows at the Mono space, because, I was, there briefly towards the end, and it seemed like a really cool, reminded me of Green Cup a bit. And so it's bring that nostalgic feel in.
Just more of a community art space than it was, these disparate groups of people from different parts of the city sort of making things in their basement together. It was more of a space where it was, you were able to collaborate more freely. We did, I don't know how many shows where, the band that would open would just be a random group of people who had never played together before, and just sort of like a freely improvised system. Which that's, was my hope for the whole project in general, was just to tear down some of the walls that usually divide people and give each other a chance to learn and to experiment together. The ultimate goal would to be develop some sort of sound that was unique to Birmingham. Totally. It's like a unique city that we come from with, a lot of history, good and bad, a lot of different types of people from the university and the medical schools. And, I just wanted to try to do the same thing with sound, that we've sort of done with the melting pot of the city. And that was a big driving force for me. I know Milton as well is really on board with everything.
And I think that's really cool, that level of openness and being very inviting because when I got pulled in, I immediately started turning to my friends and trying to let them know hey, something's happening, get in on this.
Yeah.
And my friend Abi, he's done some soundscape stuff, but has never really, shared it.
Acoustic guitar guy?
He does odd stuff on Audacity, or not Audacity,
right,
but Fruity Loops or Ableton, and just back in high school, he just got popular TV sitcom themes and then just distorted them to hell and back.
Yeah.
And spent so much time just listening to those and cracking up. But so yeah, he does these soundscapes and ambient sort of stuff, and but he never really shared it with anybody or outside of our little circle. But then when Milton and Mike got a hold of it, they're you need to come up here and do a show and do this in front of people.
Yeah.
And that, I thought that was really cool, the fact that he's not performed publicly before, but they really wanted him to get involved and do that.
I think it's important. To me, living in a place like Alabama to start with the group of people who have been involved with this can sort of pose challenges. And, I spent a lot of time here in the city because we always had a business at the farmer's market that we ran. I mean, we slept there, and been down here a great deal, but actually, you know, I grew up in the country in a really, really small place. And so, you know, I think I heard Sonny Chirac when I was like 13 or 14, and I got to him through some kind of, you know, ridiculous shred guitar thing. And I heard him in Pharoah Sanders, and it was just completely blew my mind. I've never heard instruments sound like that. But as you can imagine, being into that, where I'm from, was like really isolating.
Right.
And I know, you know, if I existed in that sense there, then there's got to be people all around experiencing the same thing. And, you know, like to me, that like feeling of isolation and alienation was, you know, was not really a good place.
Right.
I actually felt a lot of loneliness in my life. And so I just want to try to find other people who may be in that same situation and to help them see there is a community here, there is the ability to pursue your passions freely, and to have other people respect you, appreciate it, and join in on your work with you. Like, it doesn't have to be this, like, solitary existence.
Yeah. And, you know, I like, you know, for me, like, when I was coming into high school, like, I discovered, like, Last.fm, and, you know, like, that was, like, when I really started getting interested in music, and I was, like, you know, around the house, like, parents listed, like, you know, like, country music or sports radio, and or you know, like the Eagle, like, you know, classic rock, and, you know, never really got much exposure to anything outside of, you know, typical radio play stuff. And so then, yeah, like, once I started, like, hearing that, and then, you know, going to Green Cup and hanging out there, like, getting to hear, like either local music or touring bands that are just, like, you know, doing this and you know, just doing it for the love of it. And yeah, like that's you know, really,
that's the most,
like, keep me
part.
In. Oh yeah.
I was really disheartened because I was always big on just, you know, doing it yourself in general, just the whole philosophy of I'm doing this because I love it. I don't care if there's any money that comes with it. None of that's important to me. All of it actually just gets in the way of what I love, which is the creation process. And maybe I'm naive. I just always operated under the assumption that a lot of musicians in that general scene felt the same way. But, you know, I've come to find out that a lot of what goes on in independent music really mirrors the corporate system completely. It's all, you know, paying P&R guys and paying, you know, booking agents and, you know, basically giving money to people to review your music and to give you press and publicity.
Mm-hmm.
I was really disheartened by that.
Yeah, that's, like, and like, as a, you know, like I have a lot of friends who are, you know, musical artists, but, and I'm a visual artist. Like, I've dabbled a little bit in sound recently, but, you know, it's certainly not my forte. Like, so, you know, being a visual artist, like, I felt like I struggle a lot with, like, how do I, you know, go about doing my work and conveying what I want to convey, but still trying to, you know, be able to afford, you know, the basic necessities.
How do you do that? I haven't figured that out.
Having a day job is how
that's the conclusion I came to. I would rather not have as much time to focus on my art and suffer through a day-to-day job so that what I do can truly be what I want it to be. I don't have to cut corners. I don't have to make compromises.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not worried about anybody's reaction to it. You know, I would enjoy other people out there who are also into the same things to get to hear it and for us to be able to collaborate and share it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a very personal thing to me.
Yeah, and I totally feel that, and I think that's a very, like, honest approach to it, and I have to respect somebody who has that sort of mentality or that approach to their work, regardless of what it is. So yeah, like, I guess, how, like, what's sort of been, like, the general history of, like, the noise scene around here, like, because I then going back to Green Cup, that was, like, my first and pretty much only exposure. Like, after Green Cup went away, there's, like, you know, years where, like, I didn't hear about anything because that was my connection. It was only after getting back involved with Monolith and the mono space that I started finding out about, like, you know, noise is still going on.
Yeah, well, I don't know that it really was going on that much. I mean, yeah, it did, but I don't think it was a consistent thing. You know, I mean, as far back as the 70s, you had people like Davey Williams and LaDonna Smith who, you know, they're not professed like noise musicians, but they do free music, and a lot of times that definitely strays into the noise world. But you know, Milton and a few other friends, you know, had a venue that was at their house, the AC Temple, back probably in 05 or 06, and they did a lot of music there. And that's about the time Roger Stella moved here. You know, he's kind of a American noise legend. You know, everybody knows Roger Stella, except in Birmingham. Kind of the same way with Davey Williams. You go to New York, everybody raves about the guy. You ask people here who he is, and no one even knows his name. But so they really had a lot going on, a lot of interesting things happening. And then once that sort of died down, to a large extent, it dropped off the map. And then I don't guess, you know, things happened, but it was sporadic. And we started doing, trying to do shows around places in town fairly consistently. Like, we started with a little festival. It was the Southeastern Noise Conference back, I guess it was at the end of 2012, maybe. But it was just a night, and we got people from, you know, maybe 100, 200 miles away, just, and people here locally to get together and do it out of music. And it went so well, and we all enjoyed it so much, we wanted to make it a regular thing. So we started trying to do like these monthly nights, and that turned into mono. And then, you know, alas, there were problems there. But now the Firehouse has been generous enough to let us have a night each month so that we can put on another consistent program. So there'll be some avenue for people to perform that. And, you know, if anybody wants to play, just come to one of the shows and talk to us.
Awesome.
It's totally open. No hierarchy whatsoever.
So, like, you know, overhearing, like, you know, part of your conversation earlier, like, talking about, like, you know, just taking, like, the contact mic and running it through, you know, effects pedal and like, just, you know, creating, like, a loop. So, I guess, you know, you do a lot of, or do you, like, do mostly, like, sort of, like, analog or stuff with like, an effects board or pedals and that sort of stuff? Or do you do any, like, digital work as well?
I've done digital things over the years. I prefer to work with analog for a lot of reasons. It mainly just comes down to sound. You know, I mean, I'm not one of these guys who's obsessed with tone, but I can tell a difference a lot of the time in what someone's sources are. And my ears prefer analog the same way that I prefer tape to you know, digital recording, in the same way that I prefer a WAV file to an MP3. And so that's just more of like a taste thing. As far as, you know, what I use, it's, I like analog synths or any kind of modular synths. I do a lot with feedback loops, contact mics, anything that can just sort of open up a new world of sound that, you know, even though there are artists who've been doing it for a long time, it's not something that's sort of been beat into everyone's head as much as a guitar playing G, C, and D, you know. And so I just look for any kind of new and interesting sound, and then I try to contextualize it and think, what can I do with this? How can this be useful? Where can this apply in a composition? And, you know, I haven't, like, transcended normal songcraft by any means, but I try to think of new and interesting ways to put things together.
Awesome. Like, okay, and so, like, what, you know, would, or some, like, what do you like to source or sample to create some of your compositions?
Well, there's a thrift store, there's a lot of thrift stores in Birmingham, but there's one in particular that has a massive selection of tapes. You know, they've got 5, 6, 7, 8 just huge buckets of tapes, and they sell them for a quarter a piece. And so I go through there, and anything that's ethnic, I instantly buy. Anything, you know, if it's gamelan or if it's, you know, Indian flute, it doesn't matter. And, you know, there's classical stuff I'll pick up if I see something by, like, you know, Cage, you know, or I've never seen Stockhausen in one of those stories, but if I did, I would definitely buy it. But, you know, just any sort of modern composer, I like that. And also a lot of kind of 80s electronics, but I like the stuff where digital was still kind of new, but everyone was just insisting on using it, and so the sounds are just sort of, you know, they just sound like cocaine in nightclubs or something. A lot of, like, gated reverb on snares, and I'll take those tapes and I pop them apart and I make tape loops and cut up, you know, that stuff's been around for a long time. People have used, writers have used cut up techniques to, you know, develop new syntax structures, but I sort of use it more just, okay, I like the way this sounds, I like the way this sounds, and I cut snippets of tape, I tape them together, and I press play.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of deconstructing these different things to make something.
Some of the limited, like, you know, noise work that I've done was like, similar, like going to the, you know, thrift store in Alabaster, just picking up, you know, different tapes and then popping them in and seeing what, like, I got like one that it's like, some like preacher out of Texas that's just like,
they're
some
the best.
Really wild
yeah,
stuff.
Those are the best.
And yeah, just like taking that and like, you know, playing it and like the particular deck that I had, like you could like, I mean, it's like, you could like press like, play and rewind at the same time,
oh,
and it will
nice.
Like play it backwards, like at like normal speed. And
I've got a tape I love. You know, first off, when you got the preachers preaching and they're getting really fired up, anytime you run that backwards, it just instantly sounds wicked. You know, it's like a whole other place. But we got this one from Louisiana, and the guy has this really deep voice, and so I turn the tape around on the reel so that the whole thing plays backwards, and I just run that through some reverb, and I mean, I can pretty much just sit back and let it do my work for me. I didn't start with noise. I studied classical guitar. I studied at Birmingham Southern for years, you know.
Okay.
I mean, I played in classical guitar quartet, I played Bach, and a lot of different music, and I've played jazz, I've done, you know, chord melody jazz, and I've played, you know, math rock at different points just because I wanted to explore different polyrhythms. And I mean, I've done all of that. I've played in metal bands. At some point, I'm not going to say I ran out of material or that I wasn't interested, but it just felt like the return I was getting wasn't equal to the energy I was putting in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really started to experiment more with like timbral elements. And that's what made me do what it is I do now, because I've been able to convey what I hear in my head much more easily using these methods than using a guitar to attempt to get there. I feel like with the guitar, even when I'm trying to play free, I'm not going to say limited by what I've learned, but I have a hard time leaving it behind and going somewhere else. And with the noise, it eliminates a lot of that, because it's almost like aleatoric music, chance music. And so it forces me to do things and react in ways that I wouldn't with the instrument that I spent so many years working hard on.
Yeah. And I think that there's really something to that, like, you know, like I'm a fan of the philosophy of, like, you know, learning the rules so that you can break them.
Right.
And so, yeah, like, and then, like, something that, you know, sort of, you know, tangenting a little bit, but, like in Montevallo, I feel like there's a lot of interesting things developing there. Like, I'm talking to, one guy, his name's Joel Nelson. He just recently graduated, and he's still in the area. And he's been doing a couple of performances where, like, he'll do, like some sort of improvisational piece on a prepared instrument. Like, he'll like take his guitar and, like, you know, yeah, stick different things in it.
Clips, rulers,
And then he'll invite visual artists to perform alongside him. So as he's creating these, you know, improv pieces, the visual artist is responding to those sounds and then putting something on a canvas. And I was able to catch like one of those shows like a couple months back, and it was really cool just being able to, like, I guess, yeah, like, watch that unfold and develop, and, you know, the conversation that happened between the two artists.
For sure. And I'm a huge fan of visual art as well as sound. But one thing that's always bothered me about it is you always see the work, like, post-work, if
right.
that makes any sense. You're seeing a representation of something that happened when you weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love so much about improvised music is when you're there, rather playing or in the audience, the energy that you're contributing one way or the other affects the composition. It affects what's going on the stage. And so I would imagine from a visual art standpoint, even though I haven't done the visual art piece of it, I have played mixed media shows where I generated music based off of painter strokes and brush hits. That affects what you're doing. And I'm sure it's kind of interesting as a painter or as a visual artist in general to bring people into that arena while you're working. I'm not sure how you do it, but I would imagine it's a rather solitary
experience. Just shack up in the room, coffee, you know, snack or whatever, and then just, you know, go at it for hours if I'm lucky.
For sure.
I think there's really something like you know, to that, like that, you know, I guess sort of like exercise or just sort of being able to like be in that like zen state that allows you to respond to the moment rather than having like, you know, a prepared like formulaic like this is how I handle this,
exactly,
you know, scenario. I think that, like, you know, it really shows how to be in tune and that you're, I guess, competent and aware of what you're doing to be able to perform at that level.
No, for sure. And that was part of the reason that I've kind of left some of the more, you know, the rigid writing aspect of classical music behind, and why I don't really play in very many bands anymore is the free element, and that ability to respond in the live setting to me is so important. The number one thing that I like is creation. But behind that is that live element and the exchange that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's part of the reason why I've had such an issue going and playing with the band and rehearsing songs for 6 months before you ever play a show. And, you know, you're arguing with four dudes over whether you want to play an A or an A sharp power chord at this part of the song. And
mm-hmm.
It's like, that's just not interesting to me. You know, I've heard it so much. It's the same reason I grew up in the country. I love country music. I love old country music.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Sr., huge influence on me as a kid, massive. Even though I can sing it and I know tons of his songs, there's a reason that I don't have an old school country band, and it's because there's not anything I feel like I can contribute to that canon
mm-hmm.
that will be equal to or greater than what has already been said and done. So
mm-hmm.
I see no reason to do something just to do it.
Right.
I don't feel like a deep need to add to it. I don't feel compelled. If I did it, it would only be because it was something that I wanted to do, which I guess is a good enough motive in and of itself, but there's so many things musically that I have inside of me that just pour out that I almost can't control, that I prefer to focus on that rather than, you know, attempt to play in a rock band.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm going to say in a rock band.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get it. And I think that goes more into to compare it to, yeah, I guess using vocabulary that I know, like that seems like it's veering more into like, you know, fine arts rather than like commercial art, because in fine art, like to borrow some phrasing from a professor I spoke to earlier this week, it's like, artists are like creative problem solvers,
right.
And so like you're always trying to, you know, look for the next challenge or the next, like, you know, question that you're trying to find a new answer to, and so yeah, like if you're using the old established traditional ways, like you're going to get the established traditional answers.
Absolutely, and I'm not interested. And I know to some extent I'm always going to do it, but I'm not interested in simply repeating something that I've already heard someone else do.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that noise has proliferated to this point to where it's massive, it's expansive. There's genre tropes of it like anything else, but to me it is just a sound space that has been less explored than the other ones, and that's why I choose to operate in that medium.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'll loop that on. So, I guess to, you know, segue away from noise for a little bit. So going back to, you know, when we met, I overheard, you know, like you had said something about like you're raising your kid without a TV in the household, and that's what like initially brought me to contact you to set this up, because I thought that was, you know, really like interesting or novel in today's you know, world, a way to raise your kid, or at least as far as I know. I don't personally, you know, have any children. I have like a niece who's 4 and a nephew who's like around 1 now. And I see them on a fairly regular basis, but, you know, that's certainly not the way that, you know, they're being brought into the world. So, yeah, like I was really curious as, I guess, like, what brought you to wanting to raise your kid this way, and like how she's responded, and or I guess like and how others have responded to how you've been doing this.
What I'm, I mean, this is just for us. I'm not saying it applies to all kids, all parents, or some all scenarios. I don't want to offend anybody by what I'm gonna say.
Right.
It's just how we feel. But you know, you basically are whatever you do with your life. And if the only thing that you're doing is working, sitting down in front of a television and getting blasted with ads and marketing and just garbage, then that's what your life is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed, I used to practice guitar sometimes 10, 12 hours a day. I was totally obsessed with it. And then when I was about 14, we got a video game. I don't remember what it was. I really liked it, and I kind of got obsessed with it for about a week.
Mm.
I hardly touched my guitar, and then I noticed when I went back and played that my muscle memory had faded somewhat. I wasn't near the player then that, you know, I would later
sure.
be, but I could notice that I had not been practicing, and it frustrated me because I had already worked for several years to get where I was at, and I started to notice it then. And then sometime around 18 or 19, I just made the decision to cut games, to cut internet, cut television out of my life, because I saw nothing that it brought. I would much rather paint, draw, read, go forage in the woods, farm, grow something,
mm-hmm.
spend time with my family doing something real and tangible rather than sitting in front of a TV so that marketers can play ads to convince me that I need things that I don't to make me feel bad about themselves.
Right.
There's like this marketing technique, I don't remember what you call it, but they actually really started doing it in the 30s, and it's simple. What they do is they present you with the problem, and the particular one I'm talking about is for toothpaste. So the problem is you have dirty breath. Then they offer you a solution. The solution is their toothpaste.
Mm-hmm.
Then they give you a way to check to see if it's working. And the way toothpaste companies give you that check is the tingly feeling you get. Like, oh, my mouth's tingling, it must be clean. They put citric acid in the toothpaste to create that sensation in your mouth so that you believe it's really done something.
Yeah.
It's just smoke and mirrors for profit.
Yeah.
And I don't want people who think that way inside of my daughter's head.
Totally.
I don't want her being obsessed with cartoon characters and with plastic junk.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And like, I guess, you know, like for me, like I grew up with TV, and then like around like 2000 or so, I was, you know, just like telling my parents, like on an almost daily basis, like, we need to get a computer, we need to get AOL, like, you know, it's like all my friends have this, like I need to have this, and like it wasn't until like high school when I started like, you know, wanting to get away, like I took the TV out of my room, like, you know, voluntarily. I got just because I didn't want it. I still, like, you know, would get on the computer and you know, connect to
right.
people that ways, but like that
there's
was
so
when
much distance between.
Yeah.
Relating to people that work with the things that we work with.
Yeah.
And that's the main use of it, I've found.
And, yeah, like, and, you know, like, again, like, back in high school, like, I originally was interested in, like, doing graphic design, and so I got the opportunity, like, our school did this thing called, like, Job Shadowing Day. It was on Groundhog's Day. And I got to go to a local ad agency and just like spend the day there with, you know, like following somebody around. And like as I was sitting there, like, you know, he was telling me, like, you know, about things he was doing, or, you know, like how the, you know, the day typically went. And then as, you know, people would like pop their heads into his office to tell him something, he was like, hey, say something to this kid about, like, you know, what we do. And then like one of those people, you know, like said, like, essentially, it's like, you're gonna have to sell your soul. Like, that's you know, nothing more or less to it. Like, that's what you got to do. And then that, like, that stuck with me. Like,
right.
that's the message I took away that day. And I'm not a graphic designer.
I'd be very grateful to that guy.
Yeah.
I just, you know, people always talk about internet community. I don't know that they know what the word community means.
Mm.
Technology is very alienating. It's always been very alienating. It's something that you're isolated in your home and you're sitting in front of a screen talking to someone else, and it appears as words on a page. That human interaction, the body language is totally gone. I read something, and I don't know the accuracy of it, but it said something, 90-some-odd percent of all communication is conveyed not through word, but body language.
Hmm.
And so communicating through that medium, the bulk of the things that you pick up on are completely erased.
Yeah.
And so I'm not the kind of person who has this like idea that technology is some kind of great savior that's going to fix things. I actually view it in the complete opposite light.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, like, and I like, I tend to, I guess, go, you know, sort of like, you know, cyclical, like, you know, one day I'll be like, oh, like, you know, the singularity is coming, like, you know, I'm happy. But then the next day I'll be like, it's going to enslave us all.
I think it already has.
Oh, yeah. And it's drastically altered, you know, the way that, you know, we interact with one another and just, you know, view the world. Like, I, you know, forget, you know, what I saw this on, but it was like some sort of, like, you know, basically the idea would be like, you know, my generation's so used to like achievement unlocks and like, you know, progress status bars and that kind of stuff that, like, you know, we need to, I guess, like incorporate that more into like work in our daily lives. And everything becomes, you know, like the quest that you have to complete.
Yeah.
And it keeps people busy and in the trenches, and it keeps them from looking up at the big picture.
Not everything, though, there is, to me, is off. Like Bob Black wrote this great book. It's like, I think, The Abolishment of Work. It's been several years since I've read it. You know, it's like post-left anarchist thought. But he talked about, you know, organizing work structures into play rather than work.
Yeah.
To figure out what activities were actually intrinsic to humans surviving and sustaining themselves, and then figuring out how we could organize them into like a community-based play activity rather than, you know, the force and coercion that goes on now.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like, I just sit and baffle it, because I see people who work 80 hours a week. They never get ahead. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. They look just totally miserable. And I just think, like, what are you really working for to start with? Like, what are your needs? You know, your needs are food, sunlight, water, love, shelter.
Mm-hmm.
You can generate all those things without having a job at all. I mean, there, you know, you can have a root cellar. You can have wells. You can power your house with solar, or just, you know, chop firewood and go without power. I mean, I get someone would hear me say this and think that that sounds absurd. Why would we want to go back to that? Yada, yada, yada. But I got to say, like, is what we're doing now really all that easy or great? I mean, we just talked earlier. I told you about my friend trying to kill himself today and the rising heroin addiction and all the mental problems. I mean, it's indicative of modern society. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to the convenience argument, I guess I would say, well, how is what we're doing now working out for everyone?
Right.
Seems like there's a very small group who have it very well, and then the rest of us are basically struggling to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I, you know, agree with that critique or analysis. There's something I had overheard, or it's like I think it was a bit on NPR a while back. They were talking about a study done. It's called, like, I think like Rat Park or something like that, and so, like, they had, like, the control group and the experimental group, and it's like, the rats were given, you know, cocaine in their water, and the rats that were in, you know, isolated cages, like one rat per cage, they continually took in the cocaine and would eventually overdose, but the rats that were living communally in a group would taste the cocaine, have a little bit of fun on it, and then, like,
go overboard with it.
Yeah,
they had other things in their life they were drawing pleasure and happiness from.
Yeah,
that is the scenario that I'm talking about. The rat that's isolated in the cage, to me, is very similar to a lot of my time in my youth being into the things that I was in the country. It's very similar to people I've seen who are totally obsessed with getting all their social interaction from the computer. It's very alienating.
Mm.
It's very separate from what humans really do naturally.
And I want to believe that it can be utilized, like it can be like used for good, but I think yes, it's the way that it's being marketed and pushed on people that is I agree that like, you know, sending text messages, there's a higher chance for miscommunication because you're going to read into it, like, you know, a particular tone or you know, like, you know, you're going to fill in those blanks that you don't get from eye to eye, you know, communicate or, you know, visual you know, having somebody in the room
right.
with you. But
you're not really getting an accurate representation, which not that you ever can, of what someone else is saying or feeling. You're reading words, and then in your mind, you're applying whatever emotional context you feel is there. And that can be because of resentment, or it can be because of a thousand other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to be misconstrued.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's great that, and yeah, it's so convenient that, like, you know, yeah, like, we were able to use technology to get here tonight.
For sure.
But it's important that we still have that physical shared space that we're interacting with. Like, it shouldn't be just... You know, like, we just, you know, pop on the Google Glass and then, you know, you're in the virtual lobby or whatever.
That's not anything that I want at all. Never has been.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you brought up a point about if it could be used if it wasn't marketing that way. But I believe the system that we have that gave us all this to start with is inherently set up for the outcome that we have now.
Mm.
I believe that with the hierarchy, the power structures, the ideology, the dogma, everything that comes along with it, I believe this is what you wind up with every time.
Mm.
I believe this is what it manifests as, this is what it looks like. And that what you're saying is great. And I want to believe that too, personally. But maybe the older I've got, the more pessimistic I've become. But I just can't see how the system that created this in the first place can give you anything other than this.
Yeah, or like the technologies that we develop are developed, yeah, because they serve the interests of the society that you
exactly.
know has been developing.
You know, I saw this thing, and it was actually for retirement homes, and I think it was Japan, and they were marketing it because you could eliminate. I guess nurses or whatever the position there's called that would bathe the elderly.
Mm.
And so it was just this machine that a woman would get in from head to toe and it bathed her, you know. And I'm just thinking, have we really gotten to the point in society where, you know, we're going to bathe our elderly that brought us here and birthed us with a machine? Like, are we really past the point where, you know, no, it's not worth our $8.25 an hour to let a human being have some contact and a little love and care with her? Let's just pop a machine in there
mm-hmm.
and force the people who helped us get here into it. It just, I don't view technology like that as neutral. That was technology that was, by its very nature, not neutral.
Right.
Its very design was something that I'm just frankly not on board with.
Yeah, I can definitely, yeah.
Kids' storybooks. Have you seen the electronic storybooks?
I don't think so.
Tons of people have them.
Oh, you mean like the ones that are on like the Nooks or whatever? Like
no,
those,
not
the
even those.
Or...
They're like play school. They look like a book, but you can open it up and it reads the story to the kid for you. And I'm thinking, like, what a special moment between parent and child. You know, what like a wonderful thing, reading your kid a book. You know, but like now we've got an electronic device that reads it to themselves, so they can sit in the room by themselves while I watch TV and my wife is on Facebook. And you know, doesn't that just sound like a lovely life?
Mm-hmm.
No, that sounds like nothing that I want.
Right. I don't. Yeah, like that's it's really bizarre. Yeah,
it's,
like the.
It's because the powers that be are afraid of passion. They're afraid of love. They're afraid of those things. They're afraid of a passionate group of people with shared interests working together, and that goes all the way back to what we discussed about Mono and why I felt it was important to do it in a hierarchy-free, collective
mm-hmm.
way. This based off mutual interest, passion. It's like a loose affinity network to share ideas and thoughts. Because a lot of people talk about holding signs and protest. A lot of people, you know, dip out on tax dollars or squat or don't work. But to me, like, the most powerful form of protest is just to live a thoughtful, passionate life.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the thing they're most afraid of.
Yeah, like you have to live like it's like the revolution's already happened. Like you're in that mindset.
We're dancing at the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
We're not worried about trying to change this system. We have no desire to do that. We're just going to create another one from the carcass of the old.
Right. Yeah, I'm really digging everything that you're saying right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's... The more that I've honestly looked at things, and a lot of people, I don't talk this way. Very out of a very, you know, small group of friends, I don't, because you have to, at least for me, to help people understand why I say the things I do, I usually have to explain a lot of different things to mm-hmm. them, and it makes conversation prohibitive. And that's not like an indictment of them because they don't know it, because they're equally good at things that I'm terrible at. It's mm-hmm. not saying any less of someone. It's just, in my life and with my experiences, what I've studied and learned, these are truths to me.
Yeah, and it's yeah, it's like I feel like you do have to go on a journey to reach that perspective, and there's a certain amount of vocabulary that you have to learn or unlearn in order to get there. And
absolutely.
Yeah, if somebody else hasn't gone down that path, then yeah, like making that connection is going to be really difficult.
You have to carry them through, you know, everything from philosophy to, you know, revolutionary tactics to, you know, differing political ideas and history, and
mm-hmm.
you know, those aren't everybody's favorite subjects, and I understand why, because a lot of it's so dull. But you know, at one point I also wanted to be a political science major, and so I, you know, I've done a good bit of reading and study.
And I like to think, and again, this is just you know, no facts or figures to support this, but just from my own personal interactions, like I want to think that my generation or people who I know of my generation are more open, either subconsciously or actually at some level versed in some of these ideas or notions. And I was like, most of the people who I'm friends with that I speak to on a regular basis have some similar inclination or notion of this sort of collective just like the idea of working collectively and creating mutual aid networks, just trying to help each other, help one another, and not concerned about entrepreneurship or trying to make more money than their parents or anything like that.
Right, that doesn't even really factor into the thought to a lot of extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that it's, I hesitate to call it reactionary, but I think it is to some extent based off the experiences that our generation have had in our lifetime. You know, from the total dissolution with big business and Wall Street and that brand of just, I don't even know the word for it, just total capitalist insanity.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, sort of having the delusion smashed that government can be any sort of savior, because it's proven apparent through the bureaucracy and through what we have now that change is not going to come through government any more than it's going to come through big business. I mean, it's going to
mm-hmm.
come to me through a lack of both.
Right.
I mean, and I hesitate to push that line of thought on everyone, but I mean, I just got to go back to what I said before, was I think that the circumstances we have now are the only outcome from the system we put in place, you know, a long time before any of us were born.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's really important because, you know, it's like what we're doing right now is not sustainable, and it is going to end in some sort of catastrophic or series of catastrophic events.
Capitalism is a linear growth system. It has to have that to survive. So you've got a linear growth system inside of a finite amount of resources,
mm-hmm.
and so you get a time singularity. And, like, I'm sure if you put economists on, they could quantify the value of the earth and how long we could use it would. And, like, they're good at that, you know. Understanding what all that means on a philosophical level, I'm not so sure they're good at, but that's another point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's what you get. Like, you run out. Capitalism, to me, despite a lot of the other things, is unsustainable because it's a linear growth system. You can't have that with finite resources.
Mm-hmm.
It will eventually fall apart.
Like, another thing I'd heard on the radio just a couple weeks ago is, like, shipping companies are already charting proposed routes through the art circle, like after the ice melts. Yeah. Like you're gonna keep on doing it even after it's gone.
We're gonna double down, man. We're gonna start putting all refineries at in the Arctic, right in the middle of it. That way it'll be equal distance to Russia, United States, Europe. It'll all just be a hop, skip, and a jump away. Mm-hmm. And we can save operating dollars by cutting down transportation costs.
It's insanity.
With no thought to the environmental fallout. You'd think, though, that they would think about it, because really the cost of destroying the environment to them should be something that they look at practically.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
I guess, they, I don't know, like, you know, they're hoping that, like, they'll be able to sell it all back to us.
Yeah. No, that sounds right. I wouldn't say sell, though. Rent.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Extremely.
Yep. Yeah, serfdom.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
trying to get back to that, man. You know, glorious king, enlightened king, just doing so much for his people.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's so important for, communities to go ahead and build these alternative structures and systems while we still have the chance, because once what we're living under now collapse, like, that's not the time to start getting things together. Like, you need to already... Yeah.
Which is, again, why things like Monolith Radio, Mono, are important here in the city, because it gives free thinkers a home base.
Mm-hmm.
It gives us a place where we can collaborate, where we can share, where we can expand, and we can grow.
Totally.
And to me, that's really what the entirety of everything is about.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much sums up what I think too, and I really think that's, again, it's awesome that this is happening, and that all these people with these thoughts and ideas are able to come together under this tent and start proliferating that idea and getting it out to other people, because that's the kind of world that I want to live in, and that's what I want to work towards. Like, I don't want to I really love and respect my father and everything that he's done for me, but like I've seen for the past 25 years like how he's lived his life, and that's not the life I want to live.
Absolutely. And I just want to keep reiterating, I don't want people to think that I'm being critical of those who have differing ideas than me. I'm not. I mean, I very much believe in anarchy, and I believe in equality and solidarity and liberty, and I believe whatever views they want, so long as they don't infringe upon me or the rights that I want, we have no issues with, or I have no issues with, rather, but I feel the same way as you do, which is when I take a look at what they had, what they did, that's not something I want either.
Mm-hmm. Last time I was here, when we were I had the open house, I was hearing a conversation with some folks from MCAP, the Magic City Agricultural Project, and similar language was being used in that conversation about just how messed up what we've got right now is, and how crooked, and how the people at the top of it, they're calling the shots, they can do what they want and then justify it by, whatever means. It's up to us to have to deal with the consequences. And so they're wanting to try to build pockets of resistance throughout the city by using food.
Temporary autonomous zones.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Hakeem Bey or Peter Lambert Wilson, however you want to say it. It was his whole thing, what you're talking about. Whole temporary autonomous, my passion. It's true resistance.
Yeah.
At 50 minutes. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Back to the Fire. That was Shea Stevenson, we were just hearing from. And, he didn't want to plug any of his projects or anything like that, and I can respect that, but seeing as how I'm running this podcast, I'm going to provide links to find Shay's work, so if you're interested in what he's doing, you can check that out. And he doesn't have to feel bad about plugging his stuff after having been so anti-plugging. And, you know, I agree on a lot of levels about what Shay's saying. And, you know, I wouldn't plug anything on this show that I don't feel like has some sort of meaningful substance to it. And so that's why I will tell you to go check something out occasionally. And I guess the question I'm left with is, you know, what Shay was saying, I think there's truth to that about, you know, with this system, with these technologies, is this not the result every time? Or does this sort of system always create technologies that will be used to further enslave the population or tame the population, make them malleable and palatable? Because I believe, you know, a lot of life is feedback loops. Things, yeah, just self-referential, you know, because we, you know, like, somebody will look at a problem and then try to create some new technology to help assist or cope or overcome that problem. And, but you have to look at all the constituent parts within that scenario. Like, you know, if society was different, would they, you know, for one, they probably wouldn't have that problem, or two, if that problem did reoccur, you know, they would probably find different ways of coping or dealing with it, and so then the technologies would be different. But, you know, we're not living in that other world, or we're not, you know, or some of us may have one foot in one world and one foot in another, and so, you know, we find ourselves having to engage the world with the tools that have been provided for us, that we continually provide ourselves with, and until we start to use those tools to shape more tools, then we're only going to be stuck with the tools passed down to us. So I feel like we have to engage, you know, and we have to fight where we stand with the tools that we are familiar with towards a newer, better, brighter tomorrow. But then again, I'm just one person, and I don't have the answers. These are just musings that I'm sharing with you in hopes that maybe you can sift through them, see something that I did not, and then further enrich all of us for having, you know, played this game. Because I think that's the message I would want everybody to take away from this. If there is some big catastrophe coming, you know, it's not going to make situations any better if you, you know, are afraid of your neighbor, or if you're not able to, you know, still care and still have community. And I think people are starting to realize that. People in Birmingham, at least. And I'd like to make a prediction if I can, but I believe Birmingham will be a battlefield. It's going to be one of the places where this fight takes place, because we have here a culture, a history of resistance that, in spite of all efforts to the contrary, has not been erased and has not been forgotten. And it is a legacy that I feel worthy of being, you know, hefted up, put upon our shoulders, and this is the message that we need to carry forward, not the reactionary, not the antebellum ideas that some of our predecessors have taken to the megaphones with. That's done and over with. It's time to hear all the voices that they were trying to
overpower and overshadow. Seeds have been sown and are starting to sprout. A new old way is growing. At least, that's what I think. I hope you've enjoyed it. And until next time, be well.